Is it difficult for you to leave one sponsor to the next in the sense of organization, in the sense of, I would say product, because you're having to constantly get used to different things all the time. And that's also with the running of the team and the business of it. Is it difficult?
The product parts, nah, that's easy. I'm not one of those, you know, Greg Romero, anal, this bottom bracket's a 16th of an inch too low type of guys, right?
Yeah.
Love Greg. But the personal part of it, the relationship part was always hard for me. You know, riding for Redline and then having to tell Gort, hey, I'm going to, you know, take an opportunity with Supercross, which they're always very professional about it and supportive. You know, Gort's always supported me, whether I rode for him or not. And then, you know, when I left Supercross for, you know, Bill, having to have that conversation and say thank you and, you know, feel some obligation to these people because they've helped you out.
Yeah.
And Bill was also supportive and understood. And, you know, Greg, you know, I had an opportunity to race for, we had a team, Socko Energy, ended up being Socko Energy /GHP, you know, my old buddy Mike Goal had set that up through the guy down in Arizona who owned that company. And when I approached Greg about it, I wasn't sure what he was going to think about it because they were going to, you know, fund a bunch of stuff for me. And Greg flat out, he didn't even hesitate. He goes, you'd be nuts not to do it. Like, absolutely, go do it. Like, you're still riding my bike, but hey, if you got to have a Socko jersey on to have them do all this stuff for you, absolutely. And then when the Socko thing, it was only a 2-year deal, 06 and 07, and then they phased out. Yeah. And in 08, I raced for Greg again, just factory GHP, right? So it wasn't the product that was hard. It's the personal relationships and having to call, you know, I rode for a year in 2010 for Todd Lyons and SE and having to call him and tell him that I'm going in a different direction. Not that I'm ungrateful, but it can come across as being ungrateful, I guess. And I think the world of all those guys. So that was the hard part for me.
Yeah. I'm glad you understood that question. I'm glad you did, because that's the one thing. It's for some people, it's easy to just jump and it's, you know, you're behind me, I keep on moving. But you really touched on the relationship part that I was trying to get to. I appreciate
that. And I still have great relationships with those guys today. You know, I talk to all of them. You know, I love seeing them at the races and catching up with them. And, you know, I try to, if I can, I'll shoot them a text here and there. You know, I just built up a bike here not too long ago. It was a frame that Bill Ryan sent me, a Supercross Devo frame. And I call it my Frankenstein bike because I build all these bikes, whatever parts I had left. I built this bike and it's like my sprint bike, right around the neighborhood bike. And I sent him a picture of it and I think he was surprised I still had it because it's 20 years old. But I think those relationships matter. And I think you should always, you know, they say don't burn bridges. I mean, that shouldn't be the sole reason why you do it, because it's a self-serving, like, I'm going to be nice to these people because I might need them. Like, that's not the way to go. But I'm just saying that I'm glad that I have good relationships, and I would encourage everybody to understand that there is a business part of this. And sometimes they have to understand, and you have to understand whether they're maybe going a different direction with a different rider, or maybe you're going a different direction with a different sponsor. It's just part of the deal, right? And it doesn't always have to end in a bad way, right?
I agree. There's something that I'm really interested in. You're going to have to tell me about this one. Okay, in 2009, you decided not to race, but you played arena football. Arena football?
Yeah.
Where did that come from?
So I have a young man that I work with at the time. He was probably 23, 24-ish, and he played on a semi-pro football team. And I'd see him at work, and he just hounded me and hounded me and hounded me to come out and play, right? So I finally said, okay, fine, I'll come out and play, but I'm only going to play quarterback. I'm at that time I was 40. I'm 40 years old. I'm not going to go, you know, play linebacker or whatever. And so he said, okay. So I go out. They had a pretty good quarterback. So it's like, hey, I'll just be the backup. I'll just chill and hold the clipboard. Well, after the first game, the coach made a decision that they were going to change our offense up and we were going to run the ball a lot more. And so this friend of mine, he happened to be the tailback, and they elected me to be the fullback. So it went from I'm going to be the quarterback to me playing fullback. And then halfway through the season, they had some issues with their defensive ends. Defensive coordinator asked me to play DN. So I did. I ended up starting both ways. I got player of the year that year. And it just so happened that that was a gap in the AFL, and they have an indoor professional league, mostly on the East Coast. And they had came out to Utah to start a team, and they had came to a lot of our games. And the coach had pulled me aside after a game and said, "Hey, I want you to come try out for this league." I didn't think much of it. I mean, I'm 40, like I'm not making that team in my mind, right? I'm just out here having fun with some semi-pro games. Well, our next game, we came after the tryouts, and that head coach walked over and said, "Hey, I did not see you at the tryouts today. Why not?" And I said, "Hey, you know, you got former players from BYU, Utah, all these colleges. I don't see myself, you know, being able to compete at 40. And he said, if I didn't think you could make it, I wouldn't have told you to come try out. Like, you need to come try out." So I went to the next one, and he wanted me to play defensive end. I was about, I usually weigh about between 230 and 240, right? Almost 6'1", 230, 240. And in arena league, you know, most of the ends are linebacker size because it's more of a speed game. You know, you don't need to be 6'5", 275 to play the end in the arena league. Yeah. And so I ended up getting grouped in with all the D linemen. And so all the running events that we did, you know, I ran a 4.6 something 40. At 40 years old, I think it was 4.67 or something.
Wow.
I had the fastest shuttle run time, the fastest, you know, pro cone drill time, all the running tests they put us through. I had the fastest in everything. Why? Because I just got done pedaling my bike for the last X amount of years, right? I my legs were fast.
Yeah.
I could run, right? And so I find myself making the team, being the D-line captain. I got in so deep that I couldn't just walk away now, right? And this was in February when the tryouts happened, and we played our last game on the 4th of July out in Casper, Wyoming, of all places. But, you know, once I got into it, I couldn't quit. I couldn't walk away from my team. You know, they put me on the team. Like I say, I was a D-line captain and everything. So I kind of got roped into something that I didn't really know what I was getting into. And by the time I did, it was kind of too late. And so I spent that whole year, and then my boys played football and I was their coach, and that starts in July. So that year was just kind of a, you know, after I got done on, "Hey, my kids coach football. I'm going to be coaching. Maybe I'll race next year." So I just put that year off and waited until 2010.
Wow.
So that's that crazy story. I mean, I'm glad it happened. I would never, you know, the next year they tried to get me to come back. They tried to get me to come back to be a defensive coach. Like, it was just so much of a commitment. It's one of those deals where I'm glad I did it, but yeah. I'm not doing it again. I mean, I had three kids and a wife and a job, and to try to fit in practices and games and travel, you know, it's a lot like BMX where we'd all load up and we'd go down to New Mexico, or we'd go out to Casper, Wyoming, or up to Washington, or wherever our games were.
Yeah.
And it's all these, you know, 25-year-olds who just got done playing. We had a player from Fresno State, had one from Michigan. We had D1 players all over the roster. Like, literally, they used to post our 16-man roster for the game, and I'd be the only one on the list that didn't play D1 football. I didn't even play college football, right? So I just felt blessed and honored, and just it was like a dream. Like, I don't know how I'm doing this, but I'm just going to keep doing it, right? And I was old enough, like we talked earlier about the recovery part, right?
Yeah.
3 or 4 practices a week. Was basically all I could take. Like, my feet, the arches of my feet and stuff were always really sore. I wasn't, even though my legs were strong,
yeah,
I wasn't doing sprints. I was pedaling a bicycle. So it was a different set, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I was so sore. The coach would say, "I want you in the gym 3 days a week." I didn't go to the gym one time the entire season because I was so tired and just beat up and sore that I was just trying to recover from Saturday to Saturday, just trying to get through practices during the week and do the least amount as possible without the coach getting mad at me. So I could try to save up something for the game, you know, because they were all 25 and I was 41 by then, 41 years old on the team. So it was cool. It was a good experience.
Dude, that is the coolest story. I'm serious. I saw it and I was like, I gotta ask about this. Yeah. Who does this at like 40, 41 years old?
And you know what? My coworker, Seth, he deserves all the credit. I mean, he wouldn't let it go. He came into my office so many times and just bugged me. And then the fact that they all voted me player of the year that year, I was 40, man. You know, there were players like Seth. He was a tailback. He scored way more touchdowns than me. He was more of a superstar than me. They just recognized that A, he's old, and B, I did start both ways, but there were players that were talented, you know, way beyond me at 40, but they chose to give me the trophy. So I'll take it.
Dude, that is a cool story. I'm sorry, man.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this. Did any of those guys ever make it to the pros, to the NFL?
Yeah, that we had some D linemen. We actually, we had a receiver that had played for the Tennessee Titans that was coming off an injury and then went back. So there were a few that did make it on NFL rosters, whether that be practice squad or whatever. Yep. But there was a ton of talent on that team. Like I say, most of these guys just got done playing at the local colleges, which BYU, Utah State, Weber State. But we did get some from the, you know, like I say, Fresno State. And I know we had Michigan, Florida State. Like we had some top-notch college talent on our team. So, and the speed of some of those guys, I wish I could remember names, but it's been so long ago. But the receiver that we had that played for the Titans, the noticeable amount of speed he had over everyone else was just jaw dropping. The guy was so much faster than everyone on the field. He was just fun to watch, even in practice. You know, you get some of those guys that are just that much more talented than everyone else, that it's just obvious to everyone that they're just head and shoulders above everyone else. And that kind of stuff was fun to watch.
Okay. So, I got a great story for you then.
Okay.
96, I come back from college from Atlanta. I take an internship at a TV station there, and I would work, man. I was so into just being into working in the industry that I would work on weekends for free. I didn't care. So one weekend, one of the photographers says, "Hey, you know, come on with me. We're going to a Vikings game." I'm like, "Okay, cool." I didn't know that we were literally going to get on the field right on the sideline. On the sideline. Okay. This is when, what's his name?
Randy Moss. Yeah. Randall Cunningham, maybe. Was he playing there then?
Yeah. Let me tell you something, man. This is when I knew that people need to understand, when you're looking at an NFL player, it's one thing to watch it on TV. But when Randy Moss went deep, actually, this is what it was. He caught a middle of the field pass, we're way down. That dude ran right past me standing on the sideline. I've never seen anybody run that fast. I mean, he left everybody.
Oh, yeah.
And it was just like, and I got to see him coming, and I'm like, I turn and I'm like, damn, what? Yeah. Who is this man?
It's hard to believe.
It's one of those things where you see, it's like a grown man playing with kids is the way I put it, even though he's playing with grown men.
Yep. And when you're at field level, like you said, it's a whole different deal. Like TV, and even I've been to a lot of live games, NFL, you know, up in the stands, that doesn't do them justice. If you're ground level and they're running, like you said, right past you, the perception, it's just mind blowing that people can be that fast. It really is a gift for sure.
Okay, I'll give you another one. This past season, covering, we were down doing some stuff on Miami. I'm living in Florida. Okay. And to see Tyreek Hill. Okay, again, he's not a big man. But to see that man move and run that quick on the field, and you're there, you're just like, that dude, whatever they pay him, that fool's worth that money. Because, it's a whole different dimension.
It's a game changer.
Oh, man.
Yeah, it's a game changer for sure.
I don't think people understand.
How would it be?
Oh my gosh. It's like natural talent. And think of it like this. It's like all his life, he's been that way.
Yeah.
So he doesn't know anything else but to be better than everybody.
Yeah, that's true.
That's
head and shoulders.
Yeah. Yes.
No, I was going to say some of us have a small taste of that, like when you're in grade school and you're the fastest one in your class, but then eventually there's people faster than you. And he has been the fastest in his class the whole time.
All his life.
Forever.
Yes.
Yeah.
He is the fat. And so it's like he doesn't know you're living on a plane right here and his plane is up here.
Oh, yeah.
And so you never understand.
Yeah, got to respect that.
Got to respect it, man.
Wow. Yeah.
God. Do you watch much football still?
I do. I do. Yeah. I not as much as I used to, only because I'm busy. And honestly, like with all the streaming services and all that, and you have to have your local channels.
Yeah.
And sometimes I haven't had a local service to watch the games, right? Where I used to have Comcast and I had the game day and I could watch any game.
Yeah.
And then if I don't have Comcast and I'm just doing the YouTube and the Prime and all that stuff, then maybe it's not on. But I mean, currently I have YouTube TV, so I can watch the games.
Yeah.
And I really like college football as well. College football is amazing. I love watching college football. Yeah. All the years I coached, I think college football to me, most of the time, the matchups, and I can relate a little more with the chess game that's going on. You know, maybe the pro level's a little above my coaching experience and they're doing stuff that I don't really notice, but the college game, I can really notice the back and forth. And that's, I don't even have to like either team or even know either team. It's just the game in and of itself and the chess match that goes on between the coordinators that's fun to watch.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So I think it's the purest of the football games to me personally. Yes. Because
that's a good way to describe it. Yeah.
It's the coming of everybody that's really good. And then from that point, you have to figure it's a chess game, like you said.
Yeah.
The pros, the money gets involved and it's kind of a different kind of game.
Yeah.
But that college, that Division I, two good teams coming, it's a chess match.
Yeah. And they have a way better overtime too. Come on now.
Come on,
NFL. Yeah, let's get a better overtime system. I would love watching them starting on the 20 and the 30 and just letting them shoot it out, right?
Yes,
flip a coin. You always want to try to be on defense first because then you know what you have to do. Like their overtime is 100 times better, in my opinion.
I agree. No, I'm with you. I'm with you on that one, 100. Okay, let's get back to some BMX.
Okay,
cool. 2010 to 2016.
Yeah.
I would say, if you don't mind me cursing a little bit, you went to hell off. Okay. You won over 150 national main events.
Yes, sir.
Okay. What in the world happened? Were you just switched on for 6-7 years and you was like, everybody get out of my way? Or what was it?
No, I mean, my race mentality and everything was the same as when I was in Vet Pro, but actually I mean, I didn't train all that much in those years. I didn't have to. As long as I was winning, I was cool with it. I was kind of over, you know, going into 2008, like I told you, I was kind of over the points chase. I was kind of over doing all the training I had to do to compete. I just wanted to ride my bike. And so I kind of got away with it from 2010 to 2016, where I didn't train that much. Obviously, if I would have started getting beat, then I probably would have had motivation to go train. But as long as you're winning, I had to come from behind sometimes, which isn't the best way to win. But if I'm getting it done, I'm getting it done, right? And so I wouldn't say I didn't try to purposely devote myself more or make some kind of goal to go dominate. I just did what I normally always did. And, you know, when I was in Vet Pro, I was one of the older dudes. So when I start racing people my own age and I don't have to race, you know, Jason Carnes and Chad Street and Darren Mitchell and Chris Hamm and all these guys that were younger than me, it was a little bit easier for me, you know. And that's not a knock on the guys I race. That's just, it's hard to race guys younger than you, right? They're just a little better usually. So
I think your level was just, you were just at a different level.
Yeah.
And well, and to come and catch.
Well, and for me, I'll be the first to admit 2008 was kind of a crazy situation where when I started racing A Pro, it actually it took me out of my comfort zone in a lot of areas, like the rhythm section. In Vet Pro, I mean, I had skill and I would get through the rhythm section, you know, two at a time, but I wouldn't say I was probably attacking the rhythm section with everything. Cause I mean, there's a safety factor there too. You don't want to crash. You don't want to blow up in the lead or whatever. In A Pro, you don't have a choice. Like, those kids are so skilled. If you don't charge through that rhythm section, if you make a mistake, you're not going to get passed by one person. It'd be like three guys will just blow right past you. So I had to up my game and my commitment. When I hit a rhythm section, I had to go full out or I was going to get passed. So I actually got way better at rhythm sections and being able to manual and do other stuff just in that 1 year, which even to this day, now that I manual, I mean, once you get that feel and that muscle memory and in your brain, the feel of a good manual, it never goes away, right? So racing, I mean, and it wasn't my intention. It's not like I strategically said, hey, I'm going to go race these guys because it's going to make me better. I just had to be better. Now, in most cases, they weren't as fast down the first straightaway as some of those vet pros were because they're young. They haven't hit their man strength per se yet. They're not at the top of their game yet, right? I race guys like, you know, Jeff Upshaw when he was a pro that year in Pro Cruiser and whatnot, and I pull him to the first corner. Well, I can't do it now, right? And a couple years after that, I wouldn't have been able to do it because he was just starting to go up in his horsepower, right?
Yeah.
But I had to up my game. Jeff Upshaw's behind you in the rhythm section. You better be going. You know, he'd blow right by you, make you look stupid. Yeah. So it really made me going into, even though I took 2009 off, coming back in 2010 and racing, I was probably even better through the rhythm sections and skill-wise than when I left Vet Pro in 2007. And it just kind of carried over. And I wasn't really used to being in classes where I was the most skilled guy. Because Jason Carnes, he was very skilled, and he, you know, I was never going to be more skilled on a bike than Jason Carnes during that Vet Pro time. Not saying, you know, if he quit and didn't ride for 10 years, maybe I would be at that moment, but just, he was just that good. And then going into my own class, my own age group, there were many races I went to where I was the most skilled guy. I was jumping stuff and manual and things that nobody else was, which was new for me, right? So just tried to keep the momentum going. And I mean, everyone loves to win. So,
right.
You know, winners are grinners.
I love it. I know you're busy, man, so I won't take up a lot of your time. I just got a couple more questions, if you don't mind.
Okay, no worries.
If you're looking at the Vet Pro class now, what are your thoughts? Because you've been immersed in Vet Pro. So I respect your opinion on it. Yes. What do you think of it now?
Amazing. Every single series of Vet Pro champions that have been through, you know, after I left, have all been great racers. I mean, right now, Barry Nobles is the man, you know, before him, Tyler Brown, Christian Bursarine. Yep. I mean, you can go through them. Javier Colombo, you had Matt Polkamp on there. He won a world title. They're all amazing, amazing racers. Yeah. I do get annoyed when people will say, you know, Vet Pro's way harder than it used to be. I disagree with that. And I'll tell you why. Me and Jason and Eric Roop, the top Vet Pros during our tenure, we would go to a national. And if it wasn't a Vet Pro race, we went to one that was the Redline Cup Championship. And we got first, second, and third in A Pro. So, I mean, I don't know how fast the A Pros are now because they don't even have A Pro. But I'm saying there's a lot of years that, you know, it'd be hard pressed to say that the top three vets are going to sweep a podium at an A Pro race.
Yeah.
So no, we held our own against the talent of the time. So you can't really judge. It's like trying to judge, you know, today's current elite champion against Gary Ellis. Well, you put Gary Ellis in a time machine and bring him to this time right now. He would adjust and he would still win. Right. Yeah. So don't discount somebody just because it was before. Right. There was a lot of skill. And I mean, when you watch the double A's from back in the day and they had so much more pedaling on a track. I mean, you want to talk about endurance and stamina.
Yeah.
The racers now have no clue how hard that was. Right. So that they were way better in that facet than the current guys are. But as far as Vet Pro, like I said, I mean, heck, I remember, I'll tell you a funny story. It was in 2002. I mean, it's my first year in Vet Pro. I made a few podiums. I wasn't a, you wouldn't even consider myself a top guy. It might have been 2003. Either way, doesn't matter. Local track, Rad Canyon, Richie Anderson, love Richie, comes to do a clinic. My son takes the clinic. I'm there watching. He's got Ian Stoffel there, Jason Rogers there, Mikey Brabant there teaching his clinic, right? At the time, two of them are double A. Mikey Brabant wasn't, but he was like one of the top 17, 18 experts, right? Mm-hmm. And at the end of the clinic, Richie says, hey, TP, go grab your bike. We're going to do full laps. I want you to race these guys. I was like, nah, I'm good. He's like, no, seriously, go get your stuff. Go come race these guys. Okay. So I go get my stuff on, do a little warm up, whatever, and get up there. The four of us go and I won. I whole shot it and I won. And the three youngins weren't happy about it, obviously. I think it kind of caught them off guard. And Richie, he's one of those endurance, you know, stamina guys. So he made us everyone do another moto. We're doing another one 5 minutes later, which, you know, wasn't my strength. I was horsepower. I wasn't some guy with a bunch of endurance and stamina. Anyways, I think they took it to heart because Stoffel beat me to the first turn. I was in second. Jason passed me down the second straightaway and Brabant passed me down the third straightaway. But point being, first race, everyone's fresh. No one's tired. I won. Yeah. So don't tell me that the vet pros weren't fast, right? Ian Stoffel was the overall national amateur number one. Yeah. He was a great double A pro. Jason Rogers, I saw him make a bunch of double A pro mains, whatever. There were times we'd have pro-ams at Rad Canyon. Josh Owey came out. Josh Owey was amazing. He won two amateur national titles. He's 16 expert. So who does that sound like today? You know, maybe that day kid that's winning everything who's like 16. John. Okay, well, Josh Owey shows up. He's the current, you know, the past, you know, day. And I raced him in pro-am. And guess what? I won. So, you know, if you put day up against Barry Nobles, who are you going to bet on? Ooh, I don't know. It'd be, probably be 50-50, right? So I hope Barry Nobles could beat Mr. Day, because if he can't, then maybe the vet pros now aren't faster than they were back then compared to everybody's competition, right? Yeah. Not saying lap times. I'm just saying everybody raises their game over time. Athletes get faster. They get bigger. They get stronger. But it does annoy me when people want to discount my era of vet pro is like somehow, you know, subpar or not up to snuff of what current vet pro. And I'll tell you this too. Back then, we had a little bit, especially when me and Carnes were in there, a little bit of a WWE effect. There was a lot of drama going on, and there were a lot of people wanted to watch us race, even in double A. Today, sometimes the racing, a little boring. You know, everybody's too much, you know, we're all bros and there's no drama. There's no, you know, hey, I can't wait to see these two guys go at it because they do not like each other.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I had Christophe Levesque come up to me. I don't know if it was 05 or 06. Might have been 06 at the Grands. This is Christophe freaking Levesque riding for GT. He's at the end of his career and all, but he's still Christophe. And he came up to me at the Grands. He said, I can't wait to see you and Carnes go at it this weekend. I said, are you serious? He goes, dude, I love watching you guys race because you both go for it. You guys get after it. Awesome. Isn't that what everybody wants to see? Right? Everybody wants to see a battle.
Yeah.
Neither of us were backing down. He had his fans. I had mine. And I think so the interest or the promotion of the sport or vet pro, I think was, you know, just as good then as ever. Right. We had quite the little battle there for a few years. So I pride myself in that. I was part of that. And me and Jason are cool now. You know, we talk and we reminisce and, yeah. You know, I have a lot of respect for Jason. And when you're in the heat of the moment, sometimes you do and say things maybe you would change. But I wouldn't have been as good without Jason. And I know if you put a polygraph test on him and ask him if he would have been as good without me, if he said no, he'd be lying, because I know that dude trained hard and I know that he knew I was coming, you know. And I think in our minds, not any of the other competitors' minds, but in my mind, a lot of races I went to early on after like the first round or whatever, I knew unless something happened, me or Jason was going to win, right? There were weekends like that where one of us two is going to win. It's just determined which one it's going to be, right? Unless we crashed or we had, you know, a mechanical issue or something, but there were weekends throughout that where we were just better on that weekend. And I knew that one of us was going to win. And I mean, that's a true rivalry, right?
Yeah.
To have a rivalry, both people have to win sometimes. I mean, 2006 is the year that got away from me. I led the points from start all the way till the last main at the Grands. I won more races. I won more. I had more podiums. That was my year. And I crashed, hole shotted. I actually hole shotted, and Carnes was on the inside of me, and we were leaning on each other, and I slid out and crashed, and I got up and I got last. And that's all the cushion he needed to win the title. So it got away from me. But to Jason's credit, you know, he's told me to my face that there were years that I probably should have won and that the Grands just didn't turn out for me. And I respect that of him to even, you know, to say that to me. So,
not bad.
But I do have a lot of respect for the current vet pros. You know, I know they train hard. I can see how they train. I think that it's not a coincidence that all the vet pro champions have been kind of in the same mold, in a sense that they're still making a living off racing. They don't have a 9-to-5, right? When I was battling Jason, I was working shift work at the refinery and had 3 kids and a wife. And some weekends I would get off of a graveyard at 6 a.m. on Friday and go straight to the airport, fly to the track, practice, race that weekend, have to be back Monday morning at 6 a.m. So I was handcuffed to a certain extent, but if you go back and you look at all the champions, they didn't have 9-to-5s. Most of them weren't married. Most of them didn't have kids. You know, Barry, he's getting a taste of it now with his little daughter out there doing stuff. And I would say, you know, put a 12-year-old and a 10-year-old kid that you're coaching in football and every other sport, and a little girl, his girls, and then see how much time you have to ride. And because it's a balancing act, right? Dad comes first. If you have any integrity at all, you're going to be a dad first.
Damn right.
And I sacrificed what I was willing to at 10 o'clock most nights, and that's what I was willing to give. I think if we would have been on the MBL schedule where the Grands were in September, I think I would have won a couple because I was on it in the summer. But problem was, football starts end of July. I'm coaching 5 days a week. We, you know, games on Saturdays, both my boys. When am I going to find time to go over the track? Our local track outdoor closes the 1st of October. Literally can't get on a track for 7 weeks, 8 weeks before Grands. When you're racing guys who don't have the commitments and they live in Arizona, Texas, wherever, that's their peak riding season. So the Grands never lined up perfect for me as far as like the part of the year where I would prefer it to be. I don't think it's a secret that like all my big wins and during this throughout the summer was when I would go and dominate a weekend. Because my track was open, I didn't have coaching yet. You know, May, June, early July, I had more time and we had our outdoor track open. So I think if you really analyze the Vet Pro champions over the last, you know, 25, 30 years since they started it, I think there's a common denominator where they either worked in the industry or even some, I mean, like Kent Fallon, love Kent, think he was like a personal trainer where he was at the gym. Which is cool because obviously as a racer, you got to work out, you got to be able to be strong. There were factors that gave them an advantage, to being better than some people who obviously had to go to a 9-to-5 or work shift work or do whatever. Right. Yeah. I had a ton of fans, a lot of dads when I was in Vet Pro who loved and rooted for me and would tell me that I was their favorite Vet Pro because they knew I had a family and I had a job and I was like a weekend warrior, you know, and I was going up against guys who worked in the industry and their job was to go from race to race and race. Right. Yeah. Not saying that I hold it against them. I mean, I would have loved to have done that as well. I just took a different path, you know, but I think that it's worth mentioning only because when you go back to what we talked about earlier, where you create your own success in BMX, you kind of get out of it what you put into it. And everyone has a limit of what they're willing to put into it, whether that's amateur or pro. And, you know, when you have a family, you're limited. Like I said, if you have integrity, you're limited on what you will commit, right? Right now I'm an empty nester, so I can go. If I want to go do sprints, I just get my bike out and go. I don't have to worry about what my kids are doing or if they have homework or fixing them dinner, getting them in the tub, whatever. Right. So everyone's in a different place, but I just thought that was worth mentioning. If people really analyze Vet Pro and the top guys over the last 25 years, they do have something in common. Right. So yeah.
From the time that you started racing in 1978 to this morning, when you look back over your career, do you feel like you got everything you could out of your talent?
Yeah, everything that was in my control. Yeah, 100%. Like I said, you know, my injury when I was young, the financial situation with my mom being a school teacher, and you know, my mom, she's a saint in my eyes, still around. She's 84, still my biggest fan, you know. But just financially just couldn't get me to the races that I needed to go to showcase myself. That was out of my control. And having the injury when I was 22, obviously that was something that just happened. And so with the cards that I was dealt, I 100% think I got everything out of my talent that I could for the time frame. I'm very proud of the fact that I turned vet at 34 years old. Yeah. So rookie pro at 34 and never raced pro before that. I wasn't an A pro guy who came back or anything, literally just raced one season as an amateur at 33 and turned pro. And to be able to have the success, like I say, if you look at the history of the vet pro and you went back and looked at the top 10, you know, vet pros or top five vet pros every year for the last 25 years, I was in the top five every year I raced, and I don't know how many could say that they weren't a pro before that, that they literally just went amateur to vet, right? So I pride myself, you know, no pro experience, nothing, having people tell me you aren't going to be able to beat those guys, yeah, to being able to have some success. And, you know, I think about all the guys I raced, I'll forget a bunch, but you know, I raced others like, you know, Kiomi Waller, who was national champion multiple times, and I have a ton of respect for Eddie King, like so many great Hall of Fame racers that I'm just blown away. And I think that even though it was a different time, and I'm not insinuating that I would have ever beat them in double A, because it's a different time, it's a different commitment level, it's a different style of racing, so I would never discount them in that way. But just knowing who they are as a person, how competitive they are, their knowledge for racing, to be able to race with them, fit in with them, and beat them and compete with them validates me and my talent, that I was able to maximize my talent even at a late age, even at 34 years old.
Yeah.
When most people were winding down to vet pro, I was actually stepping up and trying to wind up to that level of racing, you know? So when we talk about a vet pro and pros and whatnot, so I always talk about, and I love to give Greg Hill flack about this. So I cut Greg Hill off and pretty much ran him off the track in his very last ever pro moto. So to set the stage up, we are out in California. We are at, trying to remember what track it is. It's out there by Sacramento. I'll think of it here in a second when I stop thinking about it. But anyways, doesn't matter. First moto, he cut me off down the first straight. He literally beat me out of the gate. He freaking cut me off so bad. And I didn't say anything. I'm cool, you know, whatever. Wasn't happy about it, but he got a better start than me, so it's all good. So second moto, guess what? I beat him out of the gate. I ran him right off the track. So we go back to the pits. He knew and I knew. I mean, we were hanging out together. We both knew what was down, you know, it's all good. And third moto rolls around and he didn't show up. And, you know, at that time, Greg had won so much. He was probably in the same place I was in, like 16, where doesn't have any motivation. I mean, give the guy some motivation and I wouldn't want to race against him at any age. I mean, he's one of the fiercest competitors ever, right? But he didn't show up, and I went back. So he's like, "I'm over it. I'm done." And he stopped racing. Like, I think he was riding for Harwood at the time. I don't know if he was doing a team manager thing or whatever, but he was just at that point where he just probably didn't have anything to race for and didn't have the motivation. And, you know, that day, that was the last straw. He was like, I'm over it. And so I was going to give him a hard time about it because he didn't race after that until he did race some amateur races. Yeah. I know he raced in Phoenix, I think in 08. And I know here just a few years ago, he came and raced. He raced in California and won in the older expert class or whatever. Like I say, not to discount Greg at all because he's a beast and I wouldn't want to do battle with him. But I like to tell him that I ran him off the track in his last ever pro moto. So that's a funny story.
That is a funny story.
Me and Greg. We have a lot of funny stories, so he's a good dude.
Yes, he is. I interviewed him, and to this day, I stay in contact with him. I always just drop him a note, yeah, and see how he's doing.
Yeah, he's just a flat-out good human being. I mean, that dude, he would do anything for you if he could. So, like I say, he's been like a big brother to me through all that, and like I say, he gave me a lot of good counsel and coaching through that GHP time, and took my racing, and you know. It's nice just to have somebody that you know has been there and been up for titles. You know, when we had that conversation in 2005 after the Grands, and I wasn't happy about not winning the title. And he told me basically, I mean, he doesn't candy coat anything. And he's like, look, dude, I was national number two pro 8 times. Like, I know what you're feeling right now. Like, I know that you're upset. I know why you're frustrated. I get it because I've been there. And for him just to say that and just for me to realize that he had lived it way more times than I had, he'd obviously left the Grands way more times than me, disappointed that he was just that close but didn't get it, you know? So through those conversations, that's how I ended up, you know, thinking that it was my best move to go race for him. And I was right. So he's a good dude.
Yeah, I agree. All right, Todd Perry, I want to say thank you for coming on the Lane 8 BMX podcast, man. Wonderful, wonderful conversation with you.
Yes, sir. I really appreciate it. I think what you're doing is great for the sport. I'd encourage you to keep having the guests. I'm not a big podcaster, but I've been listening to yours. And I think that, you know, the Matt Polkamp was honestly my first one. Really? I have a lot of respect for him. He doesn't know this. I'm going to tell you another quick story. You can cut it out. You can send it to him, whatever. So after the 2005 Grands, when all that stuff, when the last corner incident happened with me and Carnes, and I think a lot of people talked about it. And I don't even remember who told me. All I remember, someone said, hey, you know what? I was over there at the Red Line pits. Doesn't really matter where, but Matt Polkamp was there and somebody was saying something negative about me. And he basically said, hey, you know, in a sense, like, what do you expect him to do? I mean, he's up for the title. Like he has to make a pass. Like you wouldn't do the same thing. Like that's for the title. Like if he blasts Carnes right there and Carnes crashes and he doesn't, he's number one. Like, are you telling me you wouldn't do that? Now, again, there was more to it. I didn't go in there planning on blasting him. Yeah. And my perception was he tried to run me off the track and hay bale me, which he was a couple points ahead of me. He could have let me pass him and it wouldn't have mattered. We weren't tied in points or anything. So I just took it as a, you know, a show of disrespect. So I decided I was going to pay him back in that split second. But like I said, I've always loved Matt because he defended me and took the other side and said, hey, you might want to look at it from this perspective as well. So I've always had a soft spot and always rooted for Matt because he stood up for me in that moment where a lot of people were, you know, saying that I should have done it and I was a dirty rider and whatever they said, you know. So yeah, a lot of respect for Matt.
What did somebody tell me? They're not your friend unless they defend you when you're not around.
Yeah. Yeah. I believe that. Right. And me and Matt, I mean, we didn't hang out. We weren't on the same team together. I knew who he was. He knew who I was. He was racing AA at the time. Yeah. I mean, I always tried to treat those guys with respect, and to their credit, they all treated me with respect as well. And like you said, for him to defend me in that setting, with me not there, it would have been easy for him just to not say anything, even if he thought it. But he was big enough of a person and a man to say, hey, hold on a second. Like, what would you do in that situation? Are you saying you would do something different? Because I don't believe you would. He was just trying to win a title, you know? So, hey, next time when we talk, when we do another one, we'll have to talk about the 30 and over BS Stops Open race that we had in 2004.
I'd like to do it.
Yeah, let's put that on the list for the next one.
Okay, how about we do this? Worlds is coming up, right?
Yep.
How about we do it after Worlds?
Okay, I would love to
sit down and have a conversation.
Okay, it'd be great. Talk about the Worlds and see how it goes. Yes, sir. Know the competition is going to be tough. There's going to be a lot of world titles on that gate. You know, there's a couple guys from France. One guy's won the last two. Another guy that won last year's moving up. Domingos Thamagli, he's won a world title. I've won a world title. You know, Ronaldo Silva, obviously he's no slouch. He's won a lot of titles. I don't know if he's ever won a UCI. Doesn't matter. He's you know, top-notch rider. So you get in that main event, man, it's going to be on. I'm excited. And I love racing in big races, and I love racing better, you know, the best competition that I can. And it just makes me focus more. And, you know, normally I've always been able to do better at big races.
Yeah.
Just because of the focus and the intensity, and some people might not perform in high pressure situations. And I've always been able to do that. So I'm excited. Yeah. I just one lap at a time, just get to that main event. Get to that main event. And then guess what? It's on. Right. One lap. Yep. Right. So, I mean, I personally wish it was three laps like the pros, because then, you know, the best guy usually wins 99 out of 100 times. But one lap, anything can happen. So just lay it all out there.
I think you will.
It'll be fun. I can guarantee you, you know, I told my wife, I can guarantee one thing is that I personally will be going faster than I was in 17. And how do I know that? Well, because in 16, you know, I was done after 16. I parked my bike. I didn't touch it. I thought about doing the worlds, and then I didn't go to the first qualifier, then the second one, and then the third one. I couldn't, you know, through work and other things, it just wasn't convenient. So I just said, well, I guess I'm not racing it. Then I see, hey, you can apply for a discretionary pick. I'm like, oh man, like maybe I should do that. And I literally waited till the last day. You know, it's almost like I did want to race it, but I wasn't sure if I wanted the commitment to go do it.
Yeah.
So I waited till the last day, and I literally just put my name and my age on the application. I didn't put any, you know, resume or anything, because it's like, I'm sure those people know who I am, so I don't need to. Yeah. And since I waited till the last day, literally the next day I got an email saying you're on the team, which was the middle of May, and the race was like July 22nd. So I literally had 2 months to prepare. So I built a bike real quick, and I raced some locals, and, you know, you sit on your butt for 6 months and your horsepower goes down the drain, and you think you're going to get ready that quick. I felt blessed to go out, and, you know, I won every lap, and I didn't know where I was going to be because I hadn't raced in a while. Right.
Yeah.
But this time I had time to prepare. Like, I literally, had time to prepare. So I'm way stronger and I'm way faster. But does that mean I'm going to win? We shall see. I don't know. We'll see. But I'm going to lay it on the line. I know that. Wreckers are checkers for me, buddy. I promise you. I'm there to win. I'm not there to get second, third, whatever. I can guarantee you this, Todd. If you looked at my national finishes from 2010 to 2016 that we talked about, all those national wins.
Yeah.
So first place would be obviously the most frequent. I guarantee you the next most frequent would be eighth, because I crashed, because I'm always riding. I'm going as fast as I can. I'm riding on the edge. And there were quite a few times I crashed. Right. So if you rank my finishes, it'd probably be first, number one, and then eighth's number two, because that's just the way it goes. And I'm okay with that. Right. I'm not going to the worlds to get second or third.
No.
Right. If that's where I end up because I rode a freaking amazing race and I went super fast, I'll probably be okay with it. But going into it, no, absolutely not. I'm there to win. And I'd rather get, you know, world eight. If I'm going for world one and I crash, I'm cool with that. I'm not worried about it. Right. If I have the choice to take it in for a second or go for it and maybe get eighth, I'm going for it. So
that attitude.
That'll be fun to talk about.
You got it, bro. Thank you.
Thank you again, man. I really appreciate it.
No problem.